Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. I'm Dennis Wu with co-host Noemi Rojas.
Hi, Dennis.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Gordon L. Woods. He is Associate Professor of Medicine at the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. He's also a college master within that medical school. And we also have third-year medical student Stephanie Diebold. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Woods, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a physician. I went to medical school in Albuquerque, grew up in Las Cruces, went to New Mexico State. I'm an internist, and about 5 years ago, I learned about the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine being developed here in El Paso and wanted to join the faculty. So I sent in my application, and they brought me over where I was previously working at the University of Arizona. And I've been here ever since.
You grew up, though, in Las Cruces.
In Las Cruces.
Okay. And Ms. Diebold, where are you from? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm originally from Coppell, Texas. It's a little suburb right outside of Dallas.
This is your third year?
Yes.
What has been your experience at the medical school and in El Paso?
It's been a great experience. I actually didn't realize this program existed until about like 5 months before I turned in all my applications. And I saw a friend at a grocery store in our hometown, and she said, you should apply, and I just did. And I got in, and I really, really liked my interview experience, so I decided to come.
When you applied for, did you apply for other medical schools?
Mm-hmm. Just all the Texas schools, and there's like seven.
Nine.
Mm-hmm. Nine. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't apply to the TCOM. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And do you know what kind of medicine you'll be going into?
Yes, I want to do emergency medicine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to talk to you guys about the medical school's unique curriculum. As I understand, it's the first medical school in the U.S. to have this kind of curriculum.
That's right. When the school was originally formed, the dean decided that he wanted this school to have the most modern, progressive, forward curriculum. He didn't want this to be the same curriculum as other medical schools in the United States. They did a search, and they found a unique curriculum in Calgary, Canada, and reached out to the faculty of that medical school, actually brought faculty members down from Calgary to El Paso to help shape this curriculum, help work out the basic approach. It's a unique approach in the United States. It's called the presentation-based curriculum. Basically, the first 2 years of medical school are structured around common clinical problems that physicians see every day in practice. So rather than a curriculum based on coursework, a course in anatomy, a course in pharmacology, and so forth, each week of the curriculum is based around a common problem, such as headache or back pain or shortness of breath. And the curriculum is then built around that.
And that happens for the entire 4 years?
Well, for the first 2 years of the curriculum. The medical school is divided into two parts. The first 2 years is classwork. The second 2 years is clinical experiences.
So how many health problems are, you know, are there in the first 2 years?
We're able to build our curriculum around about 90 common clinical problems, and those are presented over 2 years of the curriculum.
And how has that been? How was that for you, Ms. Diebold, that clinic-based presentation?
I guess I wouldn't be able to compare it with the normal curriculum just because I've never experienced that. But I thought it was nice because you get to repeat some topics. For example, in anatomy, if you are talking about sore throat, you go over the anatomy of the throat and the neck. And then maybe for another pathology, you get to repeat that in case you didn't learn it enough or it's just a little reminder of what you maybe miss.
Okay. And so it's not till the third year that students are actually in a clinic or a hospital?
There are some clinical experiences during the first 2 years. And also the students have their own free clinic that they run themselves. But the third year is exclusively, and the third and fourth year is exclusively clinical experiences.
Yes, you mentioned the student-run clinic. That ribbon cutting just happened in late January, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And it's a free clinic.
It's a free clinic.
And it's in the Sparks community. That's in El Paso County.
This project, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. This project was really the brainchild of two medical students who are currently third-year students. They basically wanted to start a free clinic and organized this, got support from various organizations, got support from the dean's office, found a vacant clinic in the Colonia of Sparks, and made this happen.
And from what I understand, or from what I read in the El Paso Inc., having a student-run clinic was something students always asked about since the opening of the medical school.
That's right. Most medical schools in the United States have a student-run free clinic. That's sort of a project that almost all medical schools encourage the students to develop. And we didn't have one here until our two students, Andy and Chetna, decided to get one going.
So how has that been since it's open now, what, 3-4 weeks now?
It's been busy. We actually had our very first clinics in November. The ribbon cutting, as you know, was recently. Our very first time we opened the doors, 22 people were standing in line outside the clinic.
And were they children, adults, all different kinds?
Both children and adults. None of them had health insurance. Almost all of them were Spanish-speaking. And it's been that way ever since.
That's great.
It's an unusual community, Sparks is. It's been around for years. With the free clinic in that region, you could almost treat that as a model for other free clinics if you so desire, right?
That's right. And, of course, the difficulty with a free clinic is staffing the free clinic. Now, the physicians of Texas Tech University are supporting the students whenever the students go out. And in order to hold a free clinic, we typically have a contingent of about 16 medical students and 4 or 5 faculty clinicians, both pediatricians, family medicines, and adult medicine physicians. So it's a big job to actually staff one of those clinics. It's a difficult model to replicate because of the demands on the faculty and on the students.
I know that University Medical Center is one of your teaching hospitals.
Mm-hmm, our principal teaching hospital.
But you also have students in other places like William Beaumont, I believe, also.
A lot of students go up to William Beaumont. You've been up there, mm-hmm. haven't you,
yeah,
Stephanie?
Yeah, I did. What other facilities do they go to?
You know, I think that some of the private clinics around town and hospitals will have students rotating through their, mm-hmm. their experiences, really basically wherever the students need to go. And also students sometimes do elective experiences in other parts of the state, in Houston or Dallas or San Antonio.
Yeah. So even like the private Sierra Providence hospitals here in town? And
I'm not sure about Sierra. I know Las Palmas, some people have gotten to go over there with OBGYN and surgery procedures.
But does William Beaumont have an emergency room?
Yes.
It does.
It's a small one, but they have one.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was that experience for you?
So I was at William Beaumont during my internal medicine rotation. So I was there for 3 weeks. So sometimes we would go in the emergency room and collect the patients, but mainly we were on the floor with the patients that were admitted. It was an interesting experience because I've never been to a military hospital before and nonetheless work for it. So it was interesting just being a part of that on a daily basis.
Okay. Another unique aspect of the curriculum at the medical school is that it's the only medical school in the U.S. with a required language curriculum.
That's correct. We have a curriculum throughout the first 2 years of medical school in Spanish, taught by faculty members here from UTEP. We have a contract with the language department. Teachers come over every week to Paul Foster School of Medicine and have language classes. And these classes are actually coordinated with the presentations that are being taught in the basic science and clinical curriculum of the school. By the time our students finish the 3rd year of medical school, most, I would say, nearly all of our students are functionally conversant in Spanish.
You know, I had a medical student in 2012 write a column for my publication, Synapse. And I'd like to just quote a little bit of what he said. He was from Utah. His name is Michael Osborne. And he said that he was practicing his Spanish one day with a patient. And he said that this woman only spoke Spanish. And then at the end of his visit with her, she had a tear in her eye, and she thanked me for trying to speak in Spanish and for taking the time to talk to her. It touched me deeply and helped me to understand my role as an advocate for her and for all patients. So, I mean, just to hear a medical student have that experience of trying to speak to someone in a new language and having this connection. I think that's important for doctors to have that kind of a spark.
Well, I think so. We all know Michael, and he's a very warm and caring individual, and I can see how he would have that kind of experience with a patient. But it is true, my experience at the free clinic is that the patients are extremely appreciative that the students try to speak Spanish, do converse with them in Spanish. And it's wonderful to see the students who came to the school not really speaking Spanish really are able to converse with patients in their native language.
Have you had that exchange yet with a patient in Spanish?
I probably wouldn't be the best person to ask because I was bilingual before I came.
Oh, okay.
But I have friends that were in the elementary, like the very lowest class in Spanish when they first came in, and they're doing great. So it was really interesting to see that change.
That's great. And your curriculum also has a course called Society, Community, and the Individual.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So it's known to us as SCI. We never say the full name. we just consider it a part of our curriculum as well as the master's colloquium and our medical skills course that Dr. Woods is in charge of. So that course is just for the first 2 years. We have it, I think, once a week about, and we have different meetings. So our first encounter with SCI, when we come in as a first-year medical student, they send us to different parts of El Paso, some that are just not the best parts at all, and we go with groups of students and we get to speak to community members. My group went to Isleta and they got to speak with the high school principal there, and we went to a local community center and we just got to be thrown into the community like right away, and it was really interesting. So I guess the point of the class is to have more of a social aspect of medicine and not just books all the time.
So it's like an immersion part of the curriculum?
That's right, to try to connect the curriculum to the community and show the students how to basically take their learning and integrate it into their work in the community.
In case you have just joined us, we are speaking to Gordon Woods, MD at the Paul Foster School of Medicine, and third-year medical student Stephanie Diebold. I was reading, it was described as an exploration of the social determinants, but it also explores the unique problems encountered when providing healthcare in a bicultural border community. So when I read that, I thought about all of the traditional health care that is passed down through generations. My mom would tell me about mal ojo. I don't know, Dennis, if you've heard of it. But the way she explained it to me was that when you see a baby, you don't want to just be staring at it. You have to go and touch it. Because if you stare at it, you're putting a curse on the baby without knowing you're doing it.
One of the things that we clearly talk about in SPI is the role of the promotora in healthcare. Doctors trained in the American medical system kind of have a very analytical way of approaching disease. Promotoras, on the other hand, are able to kind of translate that into culturally congruent words and language and thinking that the bicultural people here can understand, and it makes medicine work better for them.
Do you find the school here, the Paul L. Foster School, let me ask you this way. Is it fair for me to ask you to compare the difference between the Paul L. Foster School here and the College of Allied Health at the University of Arizona? I worked at Arizona from 88 to 92. And so I kind of know the ins and outs. I used to shoot video for them, but that was almost 30 years ago. Is it fair to compare or rather to contrast the two? It sounds as though there is more forward thinking here than in Arizona when it comes to bilingual health education.
I've been on the faculty of both universities, and I would say that the University of Arizona in Tucson is an extremely high-tech advanced care system where they're doing heart transplants, cutting-edge research. They also have projects that are trying to integrate their care into the community through the Zuckerman School of Public Health and through other projects. But Paul L. Foster School of Medicine seems to me to be different. It clearly identifies itself as the bicultural medical school, the bilingual medical school, and the medical school situated on the border in a bilingual, bicultural community.
Yeah, and I find that really curious about University of Arizona. I hope this doesn't sound like I'm bashing them. They're only 70 miles away from Nogales.
Mm-hmm.
They're right there in the midst of the of a bicultural and actually tricultural, because you've got Native Americans, the Tohono O'odham. Mm-hmm. You have indigent Mexican population coming to live in Tucson from Nogales. You have all of this happening, and yet we sit on the border here and embrace the bicultural aspect a lot more, I think, than Tucson does.
I would say it's the specialty of this school, mm-hmm. and it's something that I think deserves more research, more exploration.
Right.
I think that this school is situated to become a pioneer in this particular regard.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think more than anything, the SCI course and the fact that we have the Spanish language aspect of our medical school is not so much to teach us about how to get along with patients in El Paso, but how to get along with different cultures in general, because even though not all of us are going to stay in El Paso, you're going to encounter different cultures, different people wherever you go in the United States or even outside. So I think it's more of a making you aware of that even if you prescribe a patient with something, they might not necessarily take it because of religious beliefs, because of cultural beliefs. And that's something that I really wasn't aware of before going into this program. And to go and climb over that wall and be on the other side and realize, oh, hey, that's why they're not taking their medication. And I think that's something really eye-opening that we get to have here.
And important to be able to connect more directly with patients.
We just had Larry Duncan, the CEO of Children's Hospital, for an interview in the studio recently, and he said that their rooms are designed to be big or larger than your typical room because they understand the importance of having family with the patient. It helps the healing process to have tía there, or, you know.
Yes, they all come in. I was just in a patient room the other day, and I had to do a history and physical with, I think, 8 family members in the room at the same time, and it was packed, but they were all there.
Yeah,
to support them.
But I do believe that it helps, that human touch helps in the healing process. And, you know, I think there's some validity in some of the beliefs in, like, after I had my kids, my mom wouldn't let me or my child out of the house for 6 weeks. She said, you have to keep covered up because, you know, you'll get mal aire. You know, she didn't want you to get cold, or, you know. I mean, I don't know. I just think, after you have a baby or when the baby is very small, it's good to keep them away from germs, maybe, you know. So I think there's some validity in some of the old beliefs. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Woods, in your social circles or in your professional circles, have you seen that medical schools in the U.S. and around the world are noticing or paying attention to what we're doing at the Paul Foster School of Medicine?
We have attracted some attention to our school. We've had visitors from, while I've been here, 5 or 6 different medical schools have come to El Paso to spend some time with our faculty, look at our curriculum. I know that Dr. Steele, our dean, one of our deans, invited all the deans from all the new medical schools. There are 13 new medical schools in the United States over the last 5 years. And all the deans came to El Paso and spent a couple days here at Paul Foster, had a chance to meet our students, hear about our curriculum. I'm personally collaborating with some physicians from University of Illinois, the New York University in Rochester, Harvard Medical School, a couple other medical schools, putting together curriculum for medical schools that are based on the model that we've developed here in El Paso.
The presentation-based
mm-hmm. curriculum.
I see. Where do students come from to attend the Paul Foster School of Medicine?
Well, we are a state school. Texas Tech is a state-supported school, so we recruit from residents of Texas. There are a few out-of-state students, but very few.
Okay. Are there challenges to recruiting students to El Paso?
You know, actually, I have talked with applicants coming from around the state and asked them about our particular school. Our school is starting to be noticed around Texas as a school that students want to look at. They want to come out and visit us. We're developing a good reputation in the state. One thing that I've heard is that people are interested in our small class size. There's lots of individual attention, lots of small group teaching. That's not true at the large medical schools in San Antonio and Houston.
I see. Do students come from certain regions of Texas that you've, is there a trend or anything like that?
I haven't seen a trend. I see students from all over the state.
Yeah, I'd say the major cities in Texas.
And is there a kind of student that seems to be most interested in our medical school here?
I can't think of a particular type of student who'd be drawn toward the school. Have you noticed any particular characteristics?
No, we have the personalities in medical school are very different, so I wouldn't be able to pinpoint on one.
Talk to me about retention of students or residents, things like that.
Oh, within the city? Well, it's well known that medical students, they go to residency and they tend to practice in the cities in which they've done their residency program. We're hoping that students will be leaving El Paso, going off doing their residency training, and then returning to the El Paso Southwest area to practice. We've only had 5 years of our curriculum. Our very first class graduated this last May. They are currently in their first year of residency, so we won't know for several years whether those students will be returning.
For those of our listeners who've never really thought about what a residency entails, in a nutshell, what is it?
Well, after you finish your 4 years of medical school, you have the MD degree, but you can't practice medicine. You're not allowed to have a license yet. You have to go through further training in a specialty and pass a set of specialty boards before you can be licensed to practice medicine. So students will finish medical school, and then they'll go through a residency in pediatrics or surgery or psychiatry or internal medicine. I'm an internist. And after 3 or 4 years of training and passing their specialty boards, then they can apply for a license in Texas or whatever state and can actually practice medicine.
And so a residency takes place at a hospital typically?
Typically, yes.
Okay. And what residencies do we offer here in El Paso?
Well, we have quite a number of residency programs.
I think all of the hospital-based ones, emergency medicine, internal medicine, surgery, just the basic general ones, the specific ones, that's when we're not sure because some of them aren't in El Paso.
And we're starting to develop fellowship training here too. For instance, residents finishing their internal medicine residency can now stay and do a cardiology fellowship and become heart specialists. We're starting a nephrology fellowship, so we'll have some residents who can stay, do their training, and become kidney specialists and so forth. That's starting to happen.
So a fellowship is training for a subspecialty.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a subspecialty might be, is it like dermatology or?
Well, dermatology would be a residency.
Okay.
But then people might then further subspecialize in dermatopathology, which would be looking through the microscope at skin and diagnosing various diseases.
Got it. You were telling me that students at the Paul Foster School of Medicine have performed very well on national tests.
We've been really happy with the performance of our students. Our very first group of students took their licensure exams and had a 97% first-time pass rate. Our second group of students, 98%. Our third group of students who took their Step 1 licensure exams, 100% pass rate.
And does that help them with residencies? And?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, what does that mean? You know, yeah. Does that help the medical school when you have high pass rates that way?
Oh, it certainly helps with recruiting.
Okay.
When the word gets out that we have high pass rates on our boards, the students are definitely interested.
And so if a student had a high score, then the doors to residencies, a lot of doors open to them?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's basically like when it's the same process over again when you're applying to medical school. It's very similar when you're applying to residency. You have your basic grades, like your exam. It would be the MCAT for medical school, and it's the USMLE for residency, and your basic school grades, and then you have everything that makes up the rest of your personality to show on a piece of paper when you're applying.
Okay. One of the things that Michael Osborne wrote in his column was a lot of times he gets the question, are you going to stay after you graduate and do a residency here? He described some barriers to staying, but he also offered some ideas that would help keep students here. But he said, for example, in other towns where he went to do an interview at a medical school, he said that there were a lot of discounts. So like at the motel that he stayed at, because he was there interviewing at the medical school, the motel gave him a discount. He said that he also, and in other cities, he could get free passes on public transportation. He could get discounts at zoos, at amusement parks. And so he felt like if the community of El Paso, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and businesses, if they did more of that kind of thing. Like, you know how you see that a lot for military, like military discounts.
I definitely would enjoy that.
Yeah. I thought that was a good idea.
Well, we have had tremendous support from the community ever since the medical school began. And for example, I'll be at the gas station filling up my car and I'll have my Paul Foster badge on and people will see it and just come over and introduce themselves and talk to me about the school. Everywhere I go when people find out I work for Paul Foster, they've been supportive. So I would not be surprised if our local merchants supported the school in that way.
And some of them are already. They'll say UTEP student discount and Texas Tech. And so now we're being noticed and recognized. Cool. It's nice.
That's good. In case you have just joined us, we are speaking to Gordon Woods, MD at the Paul Foster School of Medicine, and third year medical student Stephanie Diebold. So we've run out of time. We talked a lot. We learned a lot. Thank you so much for coming.
I want to thank the two of you for coming in and sharing quite a lot. It opens our scope a little bit more about what goes on behind the scenes in order to get you into the field and how your transition from Tucson to here and a different type of a program that came to us by way of Calgary is really going to create a brand new model for other American schools to do. I want to thank you for that.
Glad to be here. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Just in time for the weekend, it's time for Movies for Grownups. Here's Bill Newcott.
Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only, Elaine Stritch.
The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red.
The last of the brassy, classy dames. I'm Bill Newcott, and this is AARP's Movies for Grownups. In a 60-year career, Elaine Stritch has starred in movies, on records, she's a legend on Broadway, and she won an Emmy as Alec Baldwin's cranky mom on 30 Rock. A brilliant new documentary, Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me, tells the story of the star's unparalleled career and follows her as, at age 88, she attempts to stage a one-woman cabaret show of incredibly difficult Stephen Sondheim songs. The power of Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me, comes from the star's courageous, and maybe a little stubborn, insistence on doing the show despite severe diabetes, which can wreak havoc on both her stamina and her memory.
I can do this forever. That isn't true. It's hard enough to remember Sondheim's lyrics when you don't have diabetes.
The film builds a lot of suspense over whether or not Elaine will remember the words to Sondheim's mile-a-minute lyrics, and believe me, it's not easy for anyone to do. When I chatted with her recently, Elaine dismissed that whole failing memory thing.
I have a brilliant memory. I really do. But boy, when it leaves you, it leaves you. The memory thing has become a big joke in the theater, and everybody seems to think it's hysterically funny that you get to be close to 90 and you forget a lyric or two. I see no humor in it unless I bring it to it.
In the film, there are lots of pictures of you back in the 50s and 60s. If you were to sit down with that Elaine, what would you want to tell her?
I would try to tell Elaine Stritch that she's got to be content to not to try to please everyone, because you can't. Is that what you asked me?
That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah. Okay, that's my answer.
Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me, is in theaters now. I'm Bill Newcott.
This episode was powered by Synapse and by the AARP. Thanks for listening to this edition of El Paso Primetime.